So thanks everyone for coming. And 5 minutes ago, it was really hot in this room. So I opened up that door, but I closed it. So if it gets hot, I'll try to wrap it up as quickly as possible so that it's not too uncomfortable. Today really, I'm talking about the problem of time. So this slide here is not meant to be sort of rigorous in any way. It's just going to be some vague statement about what my sort of primitive take on the problem of time is in the context of GR. And then what I'm going to do is the whole point is not actually to look at the problem of time in general relativity, but in a simpler theory, a theory that's just basically equivalent to non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So anyways, this is the problem of time. In general relativity, you get the Hamiltonian constraint. So the Hamiltonian of general relativity is identically equal to zero. But then you have constraints. And so those constraints are the Hamiltonian. And then you get the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, right? So most people know this, but I'm just highlighting the features of it. The solutions are energy eigenstates. But what's really important is that, especially for our purposes, is that there's no time derivative, right? There's no time in the Hamiltonian. And so what you can say is that essentially the wave function is frozen in time. And so, again, I'm not trying to be really rigorous about stating this problem. I'm just generally saying we have this issue in general relativity where we don't know how to get time out of the theory. Okay. Now, the same is true in this theory that I'm going to talk about in a second. I'm going to describe the theory in a lot of detail in a minute. But for now, I'll just tell you that there's also Hamiltonian constraint. And this is just non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It's non-relativistic. Classically, it's just equivalent to Newton's theory of classical mechanics. But when you quantize it, you get a Hamiltonian constraint. And then instead of getting the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you get the time-independent Schrodinger equation. Right? So the solutions are energy eigenstates. Can anyone see the bottom of this? Yeah? OK. And there's no time derivative in this Hamiltonian. So again, you can say our solutions are just frozen in time. Right? So the idea of this toy model is to basically get rid of all the excess baggage that you have in general relativity. Right? In general relativity, we have diffeomorphism constraint, Gauss law, and complicated differential geometry that we have to work with. But in this theory, we just have this problem right on its own. So the idea is that we're going to look at the problem of the Hamiltonian constraint directly and see what we can do in the simple model. All right? And then hopefully we can gain a little bit of intuition for the full problem. All right, so that's the idea. That's the motivation. Now I'm going to just be talking about this theory that I call Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti theory. And I've abbreviated it JBB because I don't want to write Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti theory throughout the whole slide. Okay, so hopefully you can remember that JBB stands for that. Now, the idea is, okay, I've just told you the answer that you get when you do a canonical quantization. The wave function is no time derivative, it's static. Now that seems like a bad thing. But what I'm going to argue in this talk is that the path integral quantization gives us more insight. Sort of tells us about the intermediate steps between the classical theory and the quantum theory. And then we can look at that and we can actually piece together where time disappears. Because one thing I should say is that classically, this theory is equivalent to classical mechanics. So you do get, even though you start with a theory that is inherently timeless, all right, and I'll show you exactly what I mean, you can find a concept of time that emerges from the theory. The problem is, can we do the same thing quantum mechanically? And so let me just sort of sketch out what I want to do with this talk, OK? So we have this classical Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti theory. And from it, you can get an emergent time. So classically, it's equivalent to just parameterized Newtonian mechanics. I'll talk about this theory to you. Okay. Then what we can do is we can do the path integral quantization of both theories, all right? And then we can compare them. Now the idea is that there's this emergent time that happens over here on the classical side. Can the same thing happen quantum mechanically? And what we're going to look at is we're going to compare the two path integrals and see if there is, and see what we can see. And what we find is that, in fact, off shell, the notion of time, there is no notion of time quantum mechanically. But in the stationary phase approximation, there is such time. So I'll tell you what that is. OK. So let me begin.
What was that into? Can you go back?
Yeah.
What was the second row? There's the first row in the classical
theory. Oh, OK. So this is the classical theory. Yeah. This is just the path integral quantization, and this is the quantum theory.
Right. And then there's the second, what was the second row?
You mean the second row?
Thing,
yeah. That is just saying that, okay, we have these two theories. They're not the same, okay? But classically, you can start with here, and you can find some sort of emergent time and make it to this other theory, which is just Newtonian mechanics.
It's just an intermediate step between?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'll show you what I mean by it, how you get the emergent time.
I was just asking whether there are three rows and not just two rows.
There's really two rows. That's just the transition between them. Sorry. Okay. Okay, so this is the outline. I'm going to talk a bit about the classical theory because, I mean, I know that you guys have never heard, or probably most of you haven't studied this theory before. Some of you know it very well. And then I'm going to, but the main reason, I'm going to spend a lot of time on the classical theory. And the reason is that, okay, there's two reasons. One is that it's going to set up a little bit of formalism that I'm going to need to do the quantization. But the main reason is that you can get a lot of intuition from the classical theory. Okay? And that intuition is very much preserved in the quantum theory. So then when I get to the next part, which is going to be really the technical part of my talk, you'll see that intuition just sort of hold through at the quantum level. All right, and at the end, I'll tell you what I mean when I say that I think there's a notion of time in the stationary phase approximation. All right, okay, and then I'll conclude. So let's get started. All right, let me define this theory that I called Jacobi-Barber-Ritotti theory. A mnemonic for this is just the timeless theory. Okay. This is the action. T is the kinetic energy, just given by the usual formula. And I put in this parameter lambda. It's an arbitrary parameter. You can see that this action doesn't depend on lambda, because if I take the square root of T, this d lambda squared comes out and cancels on that lambda. So really, the lambda is just an arbitrary parameter. It doesn't need to be there, okay? But what I want to quantize, I'm going to want to quantize from the phase-based path integral. And the reason is because I need to know the measure. So in order to go to the phase-based path integral, I need to know how to take derivatives. I need to take the derivatives of the q's. In order to do that, I have to define this arbitrary parameter lambda. But really, there's no lambda dependence, all right? The only thing that this action depends on are the q's, so the relative positions of all the particles in our classical system, or in our sort of non-relativistic system. Okay? All right.
But
now?
You have to restrict the range of q's, right?
Yeah, the q's are real. Right, so this is.
VQ should not be.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. So this quantity has to be positive, right? So you pick a potential, any potential, but it has to be some sort of valid potential. So, yeah, you're right. The potential has to be negative, and this E has to be positive. Or at least the product of the two has to be some real number.
So, the way you take a Q squared, then.
Yeah, so.
Potential, then you cut out part of the phase space. Yeah, these are the classically forbidden regions.
Yeah.
And the classical level, it's okay. When you need to find,
okay, so yeah. Yeah, there probably will be issues with, yeah. Yeah, I didn't look into that, but I yeah, okay. So I'll leave it at that. Okay. Yeah, so that's a good point. It's a difference from the standard theory.
It's related to the tunneling as well. When you need to have this classical
Anyways, so if you take the start of this action and you just do a variation with respect to the q's, you get these equations of motion. Now, this probably doesn't look all that familiar unless you, you use this definition. You define what I call just the Barber-Bitotti time, okay? And it's gauge invariant. So this is, if I bring the d lambda over here, it cancels with the d lambda from inside the root. And so really, this Barber-Bitotti time doesn't depend on lambda either. But when you make this definition, it simplifies these equations of motion. And then you get something that is very familiar. These are just Newton's laws. So this is the idea. This is what I mean by emergent time. You get these equations of motion here, and then you define this quantity, this gauge invariant quantity, with respect to the various positions and the displacements of the particles. And you get, and then when you write the equations of motion in terms of that quantity, you just get Newton's laws. Okay. Any questions? No. Okay. Good. So I just want to point out this definition here. If you integrate over what I had before, you get what's called the Barber-Bitotti time. And right now I want to mention the intuition that you get from looking at this. So the idea is that, maybe I should draw a picture here. So if I have configuration space Q1, Q2, I have some classical path that's bounded by 2 points. Then I get a unique time for a particular choice of E. So if I say that, so E, I guess, is the sort of the energy that you give the universe. And if I specify an E, then I have a unique time. So that T would be the time that elapsed in the system while it moved from here to here.
So E is not just a sum plus
B. Yeah, E is a, I should have said it, E is a free parameter of the theory. Okay.
Did you go back to the thing when you go to,
yep,
to the Newton's equation, the E has disappeared. Right? So
yeah.
In equation 5.
Yeah, but
so
that's,
it's not an equivalence in some sense, because there the E is.
Yeah. So what you get is you get Newton's laws. You get standard classical mechanics, but only for some at one particular energy E. So you specify E, and then you have the same evolution for a fixed energy. Yeah. So where does it disappear? Well, the E is still in this TBB, right? So I guess it looks deceivingly more like Newtonian mechanics than it really is. But you get the same equations of motion. Right. You get the same, if you have a particular system with boundary conditions, you get the exact same result. But in this case, you need to specify the energy. Whereas in, yes?
Just maybe you would like to say, if you square both sides of the equation in the box, and
yeah,
it says that in that gauge, E, T plus B is equal to E.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So
the gauge right on there is equal to the channel. Yeah.
That's right. And in fact, if you take derivatives, if you define the kinetic energy in terms of derivatives with respect to T, then you get conservation of energy. So this equation is really buried in this is conservation of energy.
We don't actually have to say in the gauge where lambda equals.
That's right. You don't have to say that.
Because lambda drops out of that box.
That's right. Yeah.
You just rearrange.
That's right.
Terms of that
equation after
the square.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
So
just to be clear, at the end of the day, E is not a free parameter of the theory before. In other words, it's fixed by the equation of motion. You start with a free parameter and then it's fixed by the equation of motion.
No, actually, so this is exactly, I'm actually going to talk about this in a slide or two. this is the fundamental difference. And we're used to thinking in classical mechanics of, okay, we fix some sort of, we have some boundary conditions. So we have some a Q initial, a Q final. And then we input T as a free parameter. We say, this is the amount of time that's gone by. And then we get a particular solution. In this theory, you do sort of the opposite. You specify the boundary conditions, and then you fix E. Say, this is the energy. And that will tell you how much time has elapsed. So it's sort of like the roles of E and T are reversed in these two theories. But at the end of the day, you get the same result. And this is going to be an important point in the quantum mechanical version of this. Okay. All right. Yeah?
Particles with different ID will have different time.
So yeah. So
you mean different particles will have different time.
So this is a long story. But yeah, in this case, we take E as the total energy of the universe. Now, if you had some isolated subsystem, so if you had some system with a bunch of particles or one particle, and it's not coupled to any of the other particles in the universe, then it turns out that the time that you get that's emergent ticks the same rate for that subsystem as it would for some other subsystem that's also isolated. So that's kind of a nice thing. This is a unique choice of T where the time ticks the same for all the isolated subsystems. And Barbara makes a big deal about that. Okay, so let me go on. So I've already said a lot of the things that I want to say. Oh, but again, we can get a little bit more intuition from looking at this. By thinking about what happens if we just put, if we fix E, but instead of sticking to the classical trajectory, so I just wrote some classical one. If you put it in a different trajectory, you're going to get a different value of this integral, obviously, right? And in the path integral, we're doing a sum over all histories. So what that's going to do is it's going to be effectively averaging. So the path integral sums over all histories. You're effectively going to be averaging over all possible times, right? Because each trajectory gives a different time. And that's why the time's going to disappear, because you're just averaging it out. Okay. So.
But in some sense, can you interpret that as the fact that you're having a formalism with fixed energy and T is like the dual variable?
That's right. Yeah.
So you're not in the usual. You're in the dynamics with fixed energy.
That's right. That's exactly. Yeah. That's another way of thinking about it. That's right. So, good. Okay. So that's why. Okay. So. All the way to quantizing this, we have Hamiltonian. So the reparameterization invariance implies that the total Hamiltonian is zero. You get a Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. Now this is interesting. This is just, I wrote it down. You can see that if I promote these to operators and act it on a wave function, then this is just a time-independent Schrodinger equation. Right. So that was a statement I made at the very first slide that you get this static wave function. Okay. Now, the equations of motion, I wrote these down just to give you a bit more intuition. This n is a Lagrange multiplier for this constraint. And if you set it equal to 1, so really your gauge freedom is in just choosing n. If you set it equal to 1, you can see right away that these are, well, you might not recognize it, but maybe you will. These are just the equations of motion, the Hamiltonian equations for normal Newtonian mechanics, right? So that's why I call it the Newtonian gauge. But more importantly, picking these values of n is fixing a gauge. And so that implies, that will tell us what we need to do. When we're doing the path integral, we need to find gauge fixing functions. The natural ones are just setting some functions equal to this quantity, which, if you just take the dot product with p of both sides and rearrange, is just n. So this quantity is n, and we're fixing it to some arbitrary function. Okay. All right. Okay. Yes.
In the E here, you're treating it as an external coupling constant, fixed variable.
Yes.
Can you treat it as a dynamical variable? So if you vary with respect to it, do you get an equation? Yeah. Consistent or inconsistent?
If you vary with respect to E, yeah, that's what you'll find is, I haven't actually done the calculation, but I can see it in my mind. You will get something that will be some consistent equation of the motion. I think that if you vary with respect to E, what you do is you effectively introduce time. But you can see that, you'll see that when I talk about parameterized Newtonian mechanics, because here, in this, you get a P naught, which is canonically conjugate to the time. And then it's you promote it to an operator, and then right away you get the time dependent Schrodinger equation. So the question is, what is the difference between doing that? I mean,
maybe before even before you vary respect to you get the equation of motion you get is satisfied already by the other variation.
Well, I think what you're going to get if you vary with respect to E, you'll get. Well, yeah, okay, maybe.
So I always find it misleading to put the you don't have it to display the other parameters inside E, such as masses or charges.
Yeah.
I think the attitude of the Barber-Bertoni is that E happens to be, they don't write E, they take the point of view that potential is a place potential, some parameters, but you don't write it with Ranjan with respect to masses or charges or potentials. And the idea is that the E is just written there because the potential might have a constant term.
Yeah. So it actually, you can just reabsorb.
I find it very confusing to keep the E in the discussion.
Well, I'll tell you why I keep the E. I'll tell you why.
This way I was asking that. Because in terms of gravity, there's no one that moves from
this. But a cosmological constant.
Yeah.
Is the analog of E.
So that would be the end of it. Usually that's the guy who's in the game. It might be
good. So, that's true. There's an analog to a lot of these things in general relativity. But the reason why I keep E is because you can show that none of this works if V is not V has to have a term of order zero, so it has to have a constant piece. That's something that I can't remember all the reasons for it. But that's something that Barber pointed out in his book that he hasn't released. That he at first he thought that it didn't matter what V was, but then he realized that you can't have a V that doesn't have a constant term in it. So he just pulls that out separately to emphasize that it's there.
So the claim is that it doesn't work if you say a system of particles with attractive gravitational forces minus V is positive and V is zero.
That's right. Yeah, that's probably, yeah.
So I'm curious about why that won't work.
Okay, yeah. Well, we can talk about that after, okay, because I don't remember all the details. Right. So anyways, let me keep going. Okay, so the point of all of this was to get a little bit more intuition to say, okay, fixing a gauge is just fixing these values of n. This is how you do it, and this is the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, all right. Okay, so now we're going to move on to just parameterized Newtonian mechanics. And here we just literally take the normal Newtonian action and introduce this affine parameter lambda. So every time we see this derivative, we replace it with dy by dy lambda, the lambda by dy t. And then you extend the configuration space. So now you, instead of just having the vector q's, you have the vector q's with a time, right? Then you write down the action, and it looks like this. You have a t dot here and a t dot here. Okay. So it's basically the same action that you're used to, but now you're varying with respect to t. Okay. So if you do that, if you vary with respect to t, you get equations of motion for the t. Now this is related, Laurent, I think, your question about the energy. If you vary with respect to energy, you're essentially doing the opposite of this. So I think you just get this equation in terms of E, if you vary with respect to E. But I'm not 100% sure. Well, I'm not 100% sure, but okay. But anyways, in this case, if you vary with respect to T, you get this equation. And this is very familiar. I'll bring it up in a second, but this is the same formula as that we had before for the emergent time. Then when you vary with respect to the Q's, you get this equation. And it's pretty easy to see that if I just put, if I just call this Q naught time, then I get Newton's equations. Okay. So, but there's a lot of connections between this, parameterized Newtonian mechanics, and Jacobi Barber-Bertoni theory that I want to highlight, because this is the whole point, is I'm going to compare them and I'm going to try to see how the time might emerge quantum mechanically. So basically what I'm looking at is Here I have a theory where I know there's an absolute time, and I have a theory where I just have an emergent time. I quantize the two. Where do we lose? Classically, they're the same. What happens when we quantize?
Okay. I didn't quite.
Yeah?
What have you done there to introduce? Did you say you introduced time as an independent?
Yeah. This equation is literally conservation of energy.
Before, how did you introduce time?
What did I do? Okay, well, so in T, you have.
I guess he's asking what's the extension of the configuration space which you get?
Yeah.
What, going from vector to I?
Yeah, well, I've just added another configuration space variable, the Q naught. So now my configuration spaces has the vector Qs and then an extra time.
But how did you figure out what the action was when you added this thing?
The way you presented it, it sounded like a derivation. Whereas when you use a new model,
it's not really.
It's a separate model, and then you read it to the
so,
so that you derive that from the other.
Yeah, it's not a, it's something, that's right, it's another model, but all I did is I took the Newtonian action. If you have t plus v times dt, so you write the Newtonian action in terms of t.
And you're just saying you produce the so-called parameterized Newtonian theory.
Yeah.
And then you notice it gives the same.
Yeah, it gives the same theory.
The same theory. Yeah.
But the difference is that here t is a free parameter. And so you get equations of motion for it, which are just conservation of energy. Okay. All right. Okay. So I wanted to point out the similarities between this and the first theory, the timeless theory I talked about. The first one is just that these equations of motion, in parameterized Newtonian mechanics, these are equations of motion. In the classical Barber-Bitotti theory, this equation here is a definition. It's the definition of time that it gives to time. And then the other thing that's interesting is if you just plug in this value in here, you just get back the equations of motion of Barber-Bitotti. So there's a deep connection between the two. And I wanted to say one more thing, but I'll skip that.
No, you keep harping on
this. No problem.
In the parameter of Bitotti, there's no parameter E.
Okay, so where do you get E? You get E is an integration constant. So you get equations of motion that are basically the time derivative of this thing times some other things that are equal to zero. And then you integrate that, and you get this integration constant E. So again, more to emphasize, in this theory, you specify boundary conditions for the T, and then through this equation, you get a fixed value of E.
So there's a subtle difference.
That's right, absolutely.
One of them, it's very like unimodular gravity. I
think so.
At the practical level, they're equivalent, except that in one, the cosmological
that's right.
is a constant of integration, and the other one is just a parameter.
I think that's an important
relationship here.
Exactly, I think it's an important point.
Quantum mechanically.
Yeah.
The equivalence is still there. That's part of your
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Thank you. That's exactly one deeper point that I want to make is that you see a lot of analogous things, general relativity, that you see here. Okay. But there are some significant differences, which is exactly what Raphael just pointed out. That in and I've said it already, so maybe I don't need to repeat it, but in parameterized Newtonian mechanics, E is you solve for E given a particular T, and then Jacobi-Barber showed the opposite is true. Okay. All right. So before moving on to the quantization, I just want to set up a couple things in the same way I did for the timeless theory. Again, we have reparameterization invariance applying a Hamiltonian constraint, but here there's a difference, right? This P naught is now a momentum that's canonically conjugate to time. And so when you promote it to an operator, now you get the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. Okay. The equations of motion look very similar. Again, you notice if you set n equal to 1, you just get the Newtonian equations. But you also see that fixing a value of n is fixing a gauge. But here you can really tell that fixing the value of n is really just specifying a time. So it's picking a time gauge. Okay, so that's just a comment I wanted to make. And then the really important thing is that, okay, fixing a value of n is just like fixing q dot. So that's what the gauge fixing functions are going to look like. Okay? All right, so that's what I did with the classical theory. I'm glad there's a lot of questions, because this is where we're building intuition. And that's what I wanted to try to do. And the second thing I wanted to do is just to point out, this is the Hamiltonian constraint, these are the gauge fixing conditions. Now that I have those, I can go ahead and quantize time zip. All right, I think I'm going to skip this slide. But I, partly because it's a little controversial and I don't want to deal with it. I can go back to it. Okay, so, before I do the quantization, I just want to say the reason why I want to do the particular quantization that I want to start with a phase space path integral. And then basically, you don't have to keep lambda. Lambda is an arbitrary parameter. But I want to keep it because I need to know, I want to know the measure. The thing is that you could just start with the theory that doesn't depend on lambda, and then you'd have a configuration space path integral. But in the configuration space path integral, the measure is in general hard to calculate. Okay, and that's what I started with initially. And I found that it was difficult. All right, I had a big mess. Part of the fact is that, like, usually what you do to find the measure is you calculate some infinitesimal propagator, and then you find the differential equation that propagator the wave function should satisfy. But that's, even if you can define this infinitesimal kernel, it's not going to give you anything. It's just going to tell you that your wave function satisfies the time-independent Schrodinger equation. So it doesn't give you any new information over the canonical quantization. And the other thing is that if you just try to like plug through all of these, you have all these square roots everywhere, and it makes it really hard to do the infinite product of integrals. The last thing is that the measure turns out to be totally non-trivial for this theory. So just guessing at some measure or trying to pick some convenient thing is not really the way to go. You can do it for some very simple potentials, but for complicated potentials, anything that's not V equals zero is hard. Okay, so, and then the last thing is that in the phase-space path integral, we can really compare to this parameterized Newtonian mechanics. And that's the main thing that I want to do anyways. Okay, so now that I've set all that up and I've hopefully motivated the phase-space path integral, let's write it down. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Fedayeev pop-up scheme, but I'm not really going to say too much about it other than you have this sum over all of phase space, okay? But you have a gauge theory, so you have redundant variables, and you have a Hamiltonian constraint, and you need to gauge fix the Hamiltonian constraint with some gauge fixing functions that I mentioned. When you write out the action, the integration over these E's and the N's, these are the Lagrange multipliers. Just give delta functions for the H and the G. And that's really what you want to do. You want to force these constraints to be satisfied at every point. And then you need this sort of determinant here that I've written formally, which is effectively just the metric on the constraint surface, or it's also known as the Fedayeev pop-up determinant. Okay, so this is how you want to regularize the delta functions that come out from this integration. And that's supposed to give you the right measure. Okay, this is not anything new, I'm just going over it. Okay, so if we use this definition, we plug in our formulas. Oh, I should say, I set up a notation in the slide that I skipped. I'm sort of now going to a discrete form so that I can be rigorous about the measure. Lambda is taking discrete values. And so then if I have any function of lambda, I'm just writing it as fk equals f of lambda k. All right. That's all I'm doing. Okay. These are our gauge. These are our functions. And then we can calculate the fitted pop-up determinant. I should make the point that this is compact notation. There should be, you get the p naught commutes with the q naught in here, and you get a 1. So this, there should actually be a unit matrix in here. This is, yeah?
So, what happened to the thing? I mean, if you have the action in the configuration space only, which is classically forbidden regions, and that would make the action imaginary. Doesn't this problem disappear now when you go to the class space?
I don't know how to answer that question. Well, I mean, I have to think about it.
Because the action doesn't become imaginary or anything like that. It's not square root or anything like that.
I see what you're saying. It doesn't look like, yeah. I mean, there's no square roots or anything in here. But the point is that you're going to integrate over, you're going to integrate over the piece to get the configuration space thing. And then when you do that, you're going to get the square roots back. So it could just be that the square roots are hidden somewhere, or that the issues are hidden. I'm not sure. I haven't thought about those things. Okay.
But P should know about P minus P. I think you're right.
Sorry?
P would know the forbidden region.
Okay.
Well, I mean, there's an obvious extension of the configuration space to the forbidden region. You just...
That's right. Yeah, you put an I.
Put an
yeah.
I there, and
yeah.
It becomes the family factor associated with some of them.
Yeah.
It's very possible that that's what comes out when you're doing the integral.
Yeah.
The phase-based integral.
Could be.
When you integrate over P, is what's said. It's possible that what comes out is the infinite configuration one.
Yeah.
Has that replacement.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's
it's interesting to think about.
It's a question how it knows to get damping as opposed to the other. How it knows the sign on the
Yeah. No, it's definitely an interesting thing to think about. But I don't know. I mean, but in relation to what I'm doing, I don't think it changes the results. But it's worth thinking about. So anyways, I wrote this down because for arbitrary functions of f, okay, f can be any function on phase space, or of the q's and the p's, the vector q's and the vector p's. You get a really complicated mess because this potential is going to be dependent on the vector q's. So you could get something quite ugly in here. And the best thing to really do is to work out this Fedea pop-up determinant in a particular gauge. So that's what I do on the next slide. The easiest gauge to pick is just
In the Fedea pop-up procedure, it's originally written down for a gauge group. So it's important that you know the group structure because that implies that you're dividing, I mean, without going into the details, you're dividing out by an infinite measure of the group. But the invariance under the group is crucial in getting the normalizations right. So here, I suppose, you're associating with lambda just a group of translation in lambda. Is that right?
Yeah. So this may be the slide that I fixed.
Group structure out of lambda.
Yeah, so this might be the slide that I skipped. maybe I shouldn't have skipped it. But it turns out that if you want to get a history back, so if you act with the Hamiltonian constraint just on one point in this history, the Hamiltonian constraint will just move that point to some other point, right? So you don't get a physically indistinguishable state. But if you act infinitesimally with the Hamiltonian constraint on every point in the history, then what it does is it moves each point over, but it'll keep it along the history so that at the end of the day, if you act at every point, and you can prove this, you get back, you just get a relabeling of the history. And that is physical, what I call physically indistinguishable. So when you're doing this sum over all paths, what you really want to do is you want to treat it like 0 plus 1 field theory, where you have the Hamiltonian constraint acting at every point. So you have sort of like a field of Qs. Yes?
I mean, the Hamiltonian constraint acts on the whole phase space to generate motion. We have to multiply it by some delta function maps or some weird thing to get it, something singular to get it to act only at one point.
Okay.
Then, acts on the whole phase space.
That's right.
Move points on the whole phase space and case points on the constrained surface. Other points on the constrained surface.
Exactly. So you're.
That's a whole motion.
That's right. So what I'm saying, acting it on the whole history, that's the natural thing to do, but it's easy to think about it differently, and I think that's the wrong way to think about it. Is somehow think of this acting on a single point. I agree that's not really the right way to think about it. The right way to think about it is to think it acting on the whole thing. And there's a lot of confused statements in the literature, in general relativity, a paper by Kukoc where he says the exact same thing, but in the context of general relativity, where you act with a Hamiltonian constraint on a state and it moves it. It's physically different. But I don't think that's the right way to think about it, especially not in the path integral context. And what you get at the end of the day is something that's like a 0 plus 1 field theory, which is what you should expect.
Sorry, is the gauge invariance related to the deparametrization invariance?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is. That's what it is.
Yeah. That's yeah. The only. That's yeah. The only symmetry.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Well, you can add more symmetries if you have a different potentials, but yeah. So, okay, good. So that's why you're getting this. It's also why you're getting this really complicated and the generally complicated Fedea pop-up determinant because you have a. Some you have basically a different factor for every point. Okay. All right, let me move on. What am I saying here? Okay. So yeah, the best thing to do is to pick a particular gauge. And the easiest one is just to make these f some constants on phase space. You can pick them just to be equal to 1. Or in general you can pick just some constants. Now they don't have to be constants of lambda, so the f's can vary as you change. The fk's don't have to all be equal to themselves, to each other, but they're still constants over the q's and the p's. And then you just say, well, those constants are the derivative of some other function that I'm going to call time. And then I can write down the Fedea Popper determinant. It's just equal to 1, right? And so that makes everything very easy. I can integrate over. I can integrate over the these guys, the epsilons, and then I get delta functions. So this delta function is just saying that the Q naught is equal to this function t. So again, this is like picking a time gauge, and this formula is an old result. Okay, Hartle and Kukoc wrote this down in a paper in 1984, and they just wrote this down. And they said, okay, this is the kernel for parameterized Newtonian mechanics. But you can see what we've done is something a little bit more general. We can have more complicated Fedea pop-up determinants. And when we're comparing to Jacobi-Barber-Vitotti, we're going to need a more complicated gauge fixing. Okay, than just this one. Okay, so, all right. I'm going to talk about energy eigenstates because ultimately that's what we expect to get. So we can rewrite this guy by integrating over all the time stuff. So the Q naughts and the Q naughts and the P naughts. So when we do that, oh yeah, we're gonna have one thing left over. We're gonna have this zero term here that has units of energy. So if we just call that the energy, and then we apply the boundary conditions, we get a kernel that looks like this. Now I've put all kinds of information into this piece here, right? But basically, you have the kernel for parameters in Newtonian mechanics. You have an integration over all the energies, and then you have this time. Okay, this is the time specified by the boundary conditions. This is the elapsed time between the two points, and then this is some kernel, right? I'm calling it the kernel for energy eigenstates because that's what it is. You can see it that easily just by if I take the Fourier transform of this in time, I can pick out an energy E primed, and that will just be the kernel for that energy E primed, right? So there are other ways to see it, but that's the easiest way. And then I just wrote down what this expression is. It's not that important. You can ignore, you can ignore this. This is just the measure. You can ignore these terms. They're going to be the same. When we quantize Jacobi-Barbirolli theory, this part and this part are going to look exactly the same. The only thing that's going to be different superficially is this Fedea pop-up determinant and this term right here. Okay?
There's something subtle happens on it. You originally integrated over all p naughts, but now you have it just replaced with a single constant, which is a boundary thing. I just didn't understand.
Okay, so
the C is not a local E, it's one global E.
This is it's just I just called if I just had this piece here, I just called
what's
this
E. Why are the two knots have to be? That's another way of asking.
Okay, well, P naught is the momentum conjugate to time, right? So it's the energy. And then the zero is just when you do this infinite product, it's the first term in that. So if you have the measure, you're integrating from K, you split everything into.
Okay, so you just split off the first integral.
Yeah.
Well, all the other
yeah, but the reason why the first integral is good to split off is because the q's, there is no first integral over the q naught, and that's because the boundary conditions are imposed. So you can't integrate over all the initial q's because they're required to be something, right? But you don't.
So it's crucial that this different way of handling p
absolutely
and q at the boundary.
This exactly like the difference, and again I'm going to talk about this, but the thing that happens differently here is that this, all the issues associated with time have to do with this boundary term, these boundary conditions. All right, so I need to hurry up. Yeah?
So question before you go ahead, go back to the sensor.
Yeah?
So, maybe I'm conceptually confused about something. We've now fixed the time gauge. So why is there still
okay, let me go back. I'm pointing at terms in this expression that I really shouldn't be. If I had an expression that didn't fix the time gauge, then I should be pointing at that one.
No, that does fix the time. There's delta.
That's right.
But just conceptually, why is there still an integral over the lapse after I fix the time gauge?
Over this thing?
The end, why is this?
Because I haven't. I fixed it. I've done the integration over. So when I integrate over the q's, that's going to sort of force this delta function. If I integrate over this, this delta function will be satisfied. But then I still have to enforce this Hamiltonian constraint. And that'll be an integration over here and then an integration over the p naught, right?
And when you're all done, is it the form of e to the I the action?
Yes.
You get back to
yes, the absolutely. Direction. Yes. You can show that several different ways. This is the clearest way. Well, it's not really that clear, but sorry. Yeah. Well, I didn't want to go into all the details, but okay. So what am I? Where was I? Was I here? No. I was just saying that there's a difference, and the difference is highlighted in these two terms. That's all you really need to remember. Okay. So, this is what Raphael was talking about with the boundary conditions. There's a small subtlety, which is just that. The boundary conditions are literally, if we sum over all the q naughts, we get this time that we're fixing. So really, the boundary conditions impose a constraint on the functions. We're not just free to pick arbitrary functions. And there's in this case, the constraint is very straightforward. It's just this. But the analogous thing in so I made the comment that this is how you get rid of the dq naught and the d epsilon naught integration. So the analogous thing in the timeless theory is going to be exactly where we can see time being lost off shell. Okay, so this constraint is really important. Okay. All right. So now I'm just going to go talk about this. Remember, these were our, this is our Hamiltonian constraint and our gauge fixing constraint. We can calculate the Fedea pop-up determinant. The details are not that important. Again, we get exactly the same expression, but you can see this term is a little bit different, and this is also different. So let me show, put them together so that you can compare the two. This is the EGA term that you get in Jacobi-Barber-Bertotti. This is the one you get in parameterized Newtonian mechanics. They're obviously not the same. But here's the idea. Can I pick a gauge where they are the same? Yes, right? So I can if I make this choice. If I just call for, if I stick this thing in here and I stick this thing in here, then I get the same expression. That's this expression here.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. I mean, the
yep.
You have a Q dot.
Yes.
The Q dot is a P, the reference case.
That's right. So, right, that's shorthand notation for Q K plus 1 minus QK
okay.
over delta lambda K. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So when you calculate the Fedea pop-up determinant. So, okay, the point is, this is the gauge where these two terms are the same. And it also is the gauge where the Fedea pop-up determinants are the same. Okay. So that's sort of nice, is that I picked a gauge where these things are the same, and then I find the Fedea pop-up determinants are also the same. So I know that really what I have is I have the same thing. And that what that tells me is that this is just the kernel for energy eigenstates. So that's the most important technical point of my talk. And the rest of the slides, I think, will be more conceptual. Okay, it's not the most important result, but technically, yeah.
And is your argument the following, that each of these are gauge invariant, the Barber-Bertotti kernel is gauge invariant?
Yes.
The parameterized Newtonian mechanics has a different gauge invariance.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they're equal to whatever they're equal in any gauge. You can find a gauge in each of them such that the Barber-Bertotti one is equal to what you call the kernel for energy eigenstates in the
mm-hmm.
parameterized Newtonian
yes.
Since they're equal in one gauge,
it
should be equal in all gauges.
Yes. That's my claim. I spend a long time trying to make a stronger argument for that, trying to integrate things. The point is that. Okay, good.
I'm showing two things that are equal in a gauge as long as I'm sure that they're gauge invariant things is good enough.
Yeah. Ultimately, I'd like to be able to integrate over everything and then get into two expressions that are equal, but that's hard to do, especially for these theories.
But there is that little caveat, as long as you're sure that they're gauge
invariant. Yeah.
And that has to do with that issue I was raising. Maybe it's all right.
So there's that definition of these things.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so that's my claim. Okay.
You have to be careful about identifying. Well, anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the boundary conditions are very important. I spend a lot of time thinking about the boundary conditions also. And that is the next slide. So here, so I talked about the constraint. When you try to put the boundary conditions, enforce them in the timeless theory, you get another constraint on F. But it's not quite as straightforward. It's not that simple equation that you had before. And the main reason is because is that it's harder to separate the gauge degrees of freedom from the physical ones. In the Newtonian theory, the gauge degrees of freedom were just the time. Here, it's some piece of the q's. And so it's a lot harder to really pin down what it is. But you can do it, and you can show that just with some notation. You know, it's not really important to remember this, know a lot about this equation, but this is the equation. So the f's are constrained by this function, okay? What I called this thing here, q double primed, is this would be q double primed, and this would be q primed. Yeah, we're good. I got 5 minutes. Okay. Well, we started 5 minutes later. I'm almost done. I'm almost done. I'm getting to the point. Sorry? Yeah, yeah. So it's just, it's the component perpendicular to this P naught. And it turns out that this, if you look at this carefully, doesn't depend, it doesn't matter which P you pick. So, I mean, anyways, we can talk about the details of this equation later, but, and they're very important, but I really want to move on and finish. So, okay, so the point is that if we just, I mean, normally what we would do is we would solve this for F naught, stick it into our thing, and then integrate over the first epsilon. But if we do that, but don't integrate over this guy, then we get a very suggestive looking equation. We get something that looks exactly like this. So we have an integration over something that has units of energy. We have this thing that is some, you know, phase-based path integral. And then we have a piece that looks like this. And tau is just this expression, all right? It's very similar to the expression I had before. So if we plug this into here, okay, I haven't changed anything. I've just rewritten the app. I've just rewritten the kernel. I haven't changed anything at all. And this is very suggestive because it looks.
Sorry, yeah.
Sorry? No, I just
didn't hear. Depends on P and Q.
Yes, exactly.
So you can't extract it from the
integral. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm just about to say. So this is very suggestive, but it's not in any way saying that this is a theory that has a time in it. Okay. Because of what you just said, this is a function of the Q's and the P's. So I cannot move it through this integral. If I could, then I would have an expression that looks like this. This is what we had for parameterized Newtonian mechanics. We had an integration over an energy, we had a time, and then we had this thing that was a kernel. So even though it's suggestive, it's wrong. At some level it's wrong. This is what Laurent just said, that this thing is a phase-based function, so you can't pull it through the integral. And the second thing is that this thing here, this bracketed expression, is not quite the kernel for energy eigenstates. It would be if we applied that last boundary condition to it. It would be, but we need to impose the boundary conditions on that bracketed expression in order for it to be equal to what it's supposed to be. So those are the two major differences between the two formulas. Okay. Another thing that I should say is now we're getting back our classical intuition. If we just said that this wasn't, okay, because this is a phase-based function, doing this integral is just going to give you all kinds of different values for t. So you're sort of like averaging over the time. This is what I meant initially, where if this is some phase-based function and you integrate over all the phase space, you're averaging over all times. So that's why it's not a good time. But we can achieve these two things. We can move this through the integral, and we can apply the boundary conditions if we go to the stationary phase approximation. And that's my point. In the stationary phase approximation, you don't do an integral anymore. All you do is you replace the Q's and the P's by their classical solutions. So then you can move the T through, and you get the boundary conditions because the boundary conditions are contained in these, the requirement of classical path. All right. So.
I mean, the fully classical. Everything is not classical. Q's and P's.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So you're not just putting the P's on shell, so to speak.
You're putting the P's and the Q's on shell. That's
P's
right.
On shell as well.
Yeah. You have to put both on shell, and then you get. Right, so this is not, yeah. So it's a strict requirement, but so what this means is that in the stationary phase approximation, you really can call this a time, all right? Because you literally, these two kernels are identical. I'll make a more precise statement about this in a second. But the stationary phase approximation is more than just the classical limit. Okay, well, let me say this last thing first. Okay, I'm just about done. All right. What was this? Oh, yeah. When you actually plug in the values in that equation that I had, you just get exactly the formula that we had initially for the Barber-Vittori time. So the time that we do get in the stationary phase approximation is the same as the Barber-Vittori time. That's interesting. But here's the warning. Okay. But there's a warning, and the warning is that let me be precise about the statement. The statement is that the kernel for this timeless theory in the stationary phase approximation is equal to the kernel for this guy in the stationary phase approximation with the similar boundary conditions on the queues. But here, we are free to pick any time that we want, right? Then we can calculate an energy. We can calculate the total energy of the system based on the time that's elapsed, right? In this theory, we're not free to pick any time. We're free to pick any energy we want, and that will specify a time. So the statement is really, I pick some time here, I calculate the E, I stick in that E into this equation, and then I get a T that's the same, and then these two kernels are equal. Or conversely, I pick an E here, I calculate the time, I stick the time into this, and when I calculate it, the two kernels are the same. Okay, so it's a notion of time. But I'd say that, okay, good, we're on the summary. So I'd say that this result is half surprising, okay? It's somewhat not surprising because the stationary phase approximation will also tell us the classical limit, right? And we want these classical limits of these two theories to be the same. And in the classical limit, there is an emergent time, okay? If that was everything that I was saying, then it wouldn't be that interesting. It would just mean that, okay, there's a classical limit. But the stationary phase approximation is a little bit more powerful than that, because for quadratic potentials, all right, the stationary phase approximation can be exact. So when you have a quadratic potential, you can integrate over Gauss and you just get some constant. And so it's possible that if you have harmonic oscillators or something, you might be able to define a time for those harmonic oscillators within the quantum theory. I think that's really the most interesting idea, yeah?
So is it really quadratic now, the phase-based quantum, because if you integrate over the lapse and also the momentum, right? And if it's the lapse times quadratic expressions in momentum, would that make it cubic then, or is it really?
Well, when you're integrating over the lapse, you just get delta functions. So I don't really know if I understand your question.
No, I mean, it's related to the stationary phase approximation.
Yeah.
So one of the variables that the Hamiltonian or the action needs to be quadratic in.
Needs to be.
The lapse and delta, so just the.
No, it needs to be quadratic in the Q's, right? Because the Q's are the hard thing to, like the P's you can integrate over pretty easily because once you have the lapse, you just have delta functions and you integrate over the P's. And then integrating over the P's is just enforcing the delta functions. The Q's are hard to integrate over because you have some potential, right? And then you get some complicated expression in general. But the statement is usually that if your V is quadratic, then the stationary phase, you can integrate over those V's. You get Gaussian integrals. And so those just contribute some constant factor. So the idea here would be sort of like, I'm integrating over all the times, but I'm averaging over all the times. But for these special potentials, it's like I'm getting the average, instead of averaging out to zero, I'm getting some constant. That's my intuition anyways. So I think it's interesting to look at these systems, and that's really literally my last slide. I was just summarizing that. So if you allow me just to summarize, we did a path neuroquantization of Barber and Vittori's mechanics, and we found that we just got energy eigenstates. That wasn't a surprise because that's the result of canonical quantization. But we get more insight by looking at the path integral. And we notice in the stationary phase approximation, we get this notion of time emerging. But we have to be careful because it's not really a time that you can define some unitary evolution with respect to or some Schrodinger equation. But here's the idea is that maybe if we take isolated subsystems that are either heavy, so that means that the stationary phase approximation is either good or it's exact. So it could just be you have some semi-classical particles or you have some harmonic oscillator. Can you define a quantum clock with respect to the time that you get from those isolated subsystems? And then look at how the rest of the rest of the universe evolves relative to that T. Maybe you can define some sort of Schrodinger evolution with respect to that notion, internal notion of time. So, so that's the hope. But I haven't, and I have some ideas, but that's the basic idea, is that hopefully we can do that. And I think that a lot of this intuition goes into, carries over to general relativity also. Okay, that's a really important point too. That if you can do this in a simple theory, you might be able to do something similar in general relativity. Okay, so that's it. And I just like to thank these people because I had a lot of good discussions with all of them. And it really helped me out a lot. And thank you.
Questions?
Yes. Yes.
And then you say, basically, look at the semi-classical approximation.
Mm-hmm.
I just try to think of, I mean, usually in a semi-classical approximation, you have the semi-classical states and many energy eigenstates that you can.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how semi-classical can you get, or how good is your stationary phase approximation?
How good is it? Well,
if you take a
that's a good point. I mean, there's
if you take a harmonic or oscillator state, very high energy seems very unclassical.
Yeah, that's right. But the stationary phase approximation doesn't have to be. I think that's was an important point that you could have something that's not classical at all.
I thought high energy would be normally in the normal way of talking about.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
It's the large quantum number limit in quote-unquote classical correspondence limit or whatever with the people are using. Ground state is also semi-classical? I suppose so, yeah, in the harmonic classical especially.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's not less, the higher the vibration of that less
semi-classical.
No, but I'm saying they're all semi-classical.
They're all semi-classical.
Yeah, so do you have something to say?
Well, maybe I can ask a question which I think the answer question points to,
mm-hmm.
which is from the Hamiltonian point of view, you don't know how to compute quantization. From the Hamiltonian point of view, in the Barber of the Trolley theory, because it tells us that we should have energy eigenstates, and at least it's very typical for very many potentials. There are no solutions which are normalizable mathematically.
Mm-hmm.
The product that we use to define mm-hmm. the Hamiltonian constraint action or the analogical equation.
Right.
And there's an analogous issue in general too.
Right.
So it seems to me two things are possible. One of them is that your kernel that you define.
Mm-hmm.
Implicitly defines an inner product on the space of energy eigenstates,
mm-hmm.
With respect to which there are normalizable solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint.
You think you have a free particle of the assumption? Is that an example of
the word?
Yeah,
that's,
There are two different cases. There are basically that you have a continuous spectrum, or that you have also discrete spectrum, but ask for a G, which is not in the spectrum.
Yeah. So it is interesting that, yeah.
Yeah, so or what or the equivalence that you're positing breaks down because there basically is no inner product for the energy space. For example, take an energy, take a case like Yanti just described.
Right.
Presumably the semi-classical approximation breaks down because there are no classical solutions with those energies.
Right, I see.
So can you do a calculation to tell which is it that is have you solved the problem and constructed implicitly in inner product, or are you still subject to the same problem in this
program? Well, I don't know. I mean, that's the next.
One can just do this for the hydrogen atom, write down the bottom by talking things for the hydrogen atom.
Yeah.
And then you see that the bound states, they are normalized on the full configuration space.
Yeah.
The free solutions are not. And this generalized standing potential that you have a discrete part of the spectrum where you have normalizability and you have a continuous part of the spectrum.
What about the Anker space? What if you put in an E which is not?
But if you do that,
So there's a prediction. If the theorem is predict an E for you.
I think it's interesting to look at. It would be interesting to look at specific examples. So, if you had a non-bound state, if some particle scattering, can you define like an S matrix or something? But I think that what I think that is that actually all the same issues. You would have even in normal quantum mechanics, right? I mean, if you define certain potentials, normal quantum mechanics, and then you have energy eigenstates that are non-normalizable. So I really think that the places where you're going to have issues are the same places where you're going to have issues in normal quantum mechanics. So I think what's interesting is just the formal. I mean, I write down this kernel for energy eigenstates, the parameterized Newtonian theory, right? And it seems like a mathematically well-defined object. It might not be for certain potentials, right? But for the potentials where it is defined, then there's an equivalence, right? So that's what sort of the claim I'm making is that when the normal theory is well-defined, then this theory should be equivalent to it. Yeah, that's what they're saying, but okay, so.
Continuous, only one version exists, so only one version can define it.
I think if it's continuous, it's not such a problem, you can obviously define it in a some missing.
Yeah, there might be some way.
Static into the decomposition. But it's more, I think it's more complicated if you are within the discrete spectrum.
There is no solution in your interface in that way.
So, I mean, one issue.
Yeah, but they are non-normalizable in the big Hilbert space, but you can still buy the.
No, even in the physical. I mean, the constraint is very simple. You want T0 plus H equal to 0. So, you accept this delta function, you integrate over T0, and you just get an usual integral over T and Q, and that's your. That's your physical, So, with the L2, you can just the L2.
Are there any other questions besides the.
That's just a comment. So I think one nice thing that might come out is that a better control of the approximations in order to get the time-dependent coefficient. Has read Kiefer's book on the semi-classical approximation. He complains a lot on these approximations, and it's not clear that the wave functions could satisfy these approximations or not. The thing with the pattern grid is that you have a harmonic potentials. Presumably, you have stationary phase approximation is exact.
Yeah.
Maybe you can really get control over normal approximations when they're satisfied.
I mean, that's, yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that's, everything seems to be cleaner in this approach. Yeah. Do you have a comment, Lee?
Yeah, so just to go back to the original motivation, which is the analogy to general relativity. So one problem that one might have hoped the analogy addressed is the question of writing down the physical inner products in general relativity, which just, you know, to go backwards to what all of us have been saying, reaches this apparent barrier that, the solution to the Hamiltonian constraint appear to be non-normalizable in the matter and the product. And it seems like you've understood the discussion that we just had, the conclusion we've come to, is that in those cases of models where the kinematical inner product suffices to make normalizable energy eigenstates in the Hamiltonian problem, the Barber-Bertoni problem will have a solution. But that's not going to help us in general relativity, because that's precisely what we don't have.
There's a few people who look at, well, you take this analogy between the energy and the cosmological constant, they take that seriously. So they view the Wheat equation as an eigenvalue equation. And then maybe you get
this so the cosmological constant.
Exactly. So you get this three, maybe you have a discrete spectrum for the cosmological constant and the continuous part there as well.
That sounds like a beautiful speculation, and maybe want to get 10 to minus 9 to 20.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, no. But there might be some analogous thing to the parameterized Newtonian mechanic, because when you look, I think this is a, yeah, I mean, when you, if you look at the different, there's so many different forms of the GR action, they're all equivalent. And there's this bi-wheeler or bi-line wheeler show, the one that looks exactly like the Sperber-Batodi, and then there's the ADM action, which looks a lot like parameterized Newtonian mechanics. And so there could be some similar issues, right, where these theories are related, but there's issues of boundary conditions. I think it's also important, the role played by the boundary conditions in this analysis is really crucial. And so I think that's interesting. And maybe it is telling us something deep about general relativity, but I don't know what that is yet. You know, I have to think about it more. But it's, so I'm trying to be provoking partly with this talk too, I think. Yes. Provocative is the word I was using. Provocative.
That was, either your, I guess your main technical question is, are the two path integrals the same or not? And they are equivalent or not? The one based on Jacobi action and the one based on parameterized Newtonian. So I just wanted to make sure I understood your answer. And first there's an issue of what does it mean to be the, does it mean that they're the same? Because they're in different spaces. One is just in configuration space without time, and the other one is in configuration space with time. Space time, basically. But you sort of suggested what it meant to be the same.
Yeah, integrated over.
One is related to the other by a particular Fourier transform.
That's right, yeah.
And then, so far I've understood right. And then, did I understand right that your conclusion was that probably they're not the same, although you don't know. Outside of the stationary phase.
That's right.
So do you know they're not the same, or you?
They're not the same outside of the stationary phase approximately.
So you actually would get different answers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess it's about time to let Peter go. Thank you again.